Immersive cultural enrichment on board and on shore. Freshly prepared regional cuisine. Viking sails the rivers of the world and takes travelers to the heart of iconic destinations. Discover more at Viking.com.
Learn how to plan, invest, and live smarter with the Raymond James For What It's Worth podcast. Featuring insights from leading professionals, you'll get the latest in wealth management, market commentary, and engaging research. Listen today at RaymondJames.com/podcast.
I'm Jace Lacob, and you're listening to a special bonus episode of Masterpiece Studio. Lord Melbourne, or Lord M as he's more affectionately called, is no longer Prime Minister of the United Kingdom. In fact, he's not much of anything. Tucked away in Brockett Hall amongst his beloved orchids, Lord M has created a virtual Eden.
You have created your own Eden, Lord M.
Yes, it is something of a refuge, ma'am.
Lord M is a quiet, but nevertheless dashing guest at the ball for the relief of the Spitalfields Weavers. But as his touch-and-go behavior reveals, Lord M is ill and, according to his doctor, dying.
Cure sounds worse than complaints.
I'm not talking about a cure, my lord. With a case like this, the prognosis is uncertain. In some cases, there is a steady decline, while for others, things progress more quickly. May I suggest, my lord, that you put your affairs in order?
Rufus Sewell isn't really sure how to handle his status as a Victoria fan favorite. Still, following his likely departure from the series, Sewell retains a sharp sense of self amidst his position as an ahistorical idol.
He had riches. He'd grown up with kings and princes and intellects and artists. There was nothing that really impressed him. He wasn't particularly personally ambitious. He just kind of fell into what he did.
Sewell joined us to talk about Lord M, his reflections on two seasons of Victorian court intrigue, and what's next for this busy actor. And we are joined again this week by Rufus Sewell. Welcome.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Now, it seemed last season like Lord Melbourne had walked out of Victoria's life when he was replaced as Prime Minister. What brought you back to Victoria?
Well, when it was first mooted, I did have concerns. It was really nice to have originally only been booked for 3 episodes and then to be kept on a little. But even then, in the first season, I was concerned that Melbourne wouldn't be hanging around kind of uselessly in a way that wasn't particularly dynamic or serving the story. but that worked out well. So when they suggested the idea of me coming back, like, I didn't want to feel like I was hanging around or that there was a dignity to it. Like, I wanted the changes in the relationship and his status to be reflected and also to benefit from that, because the lack of complication that was arrived at by Victoria being happily married and in love and with Albert, I think in a way released them to be a little bit more pure in their relationship. The kind of fatherly advice aspect and the pure friendship, uncomplicated by all those kind of confused feelings, I wanted that to be addressed and not an attempt at some kind of dramatized triangular, you know, invented jealousy or stuff. I didn't want to be dragged into the tittle-tattle. After those assurances, and, you know, I was very happy to come back as long as there was a kind of dignified way of getting out of it, you know?
So you didn't want to be furniture at Buckingham Palace, basically?
No, and I don't want to be hanging around like some kind of magic granny in a bath chair dispensing advice on Christmas specials, you know?
What do you think is behind the appeal of Lord M for viewers?
Well, I think it was the same appeal that struck me when I read the script and was initially suspicious, as I've said, that he was some kind of concoction, a kind of Frankenstein figure cobbled together from different romantic, you know, heroes and figures, because he was so interesting and the relationship was so interesting. I was surprised that it hadn't been explored before. So I was initially suspicious, and I asked Daisy if it was all true, and she said it was. And then I read up a lot about him, and I kind of fell for him because he was such a distinct and interesting and very, very likable and in many ways admirable character, and refreshingly honest and just himself. You know, the great thing that I think appealed to Victoria about him, and it was very important because he was really the first man that she'd ever been alone with and the first person, I think very importantly, that didn't want anything from her, because he had position, he had riches, he'd grown up with kings and princes and intellects and artists. There was nothing that really impressed him. He wasn't particularly personally ambitious. He just kind of fell into what he did. He was very much his own man. And in many ways, as he got older, he got more, you know, odder and funnier and, you know, and in a way, I was slightly disappointed that we didn't get to explore how he would fall asleep at the dinner table and mutter to himself.
You and Jenna Coleman have such a natural chemistry together. What was it like returning to film these new scenes opposite Jenna?
It was lovely. It was great fun. And it was different in a way that it needed to be. You know, the first season and those first scenes had a particular character to them that was very much, you know, reflecting his position at that time and her youth and her position. And it would be foolish to try to recreate those things. And not only that, but you'd miss out on other opportunities to create something new. And it's a changed relationship. You know, the fact that, I mean, for me, I relished the opportunity to be more openly supportive of Albert. Because one of the things that I found a little frustrating in the first season was I truly believed and knew for a fact, actually, that Melbourne rather liked Albert. And once he got over his initial concerns, and I call them not much more than that, that Albert, who he hadn't yet met, might be someone who had no particular feeling for Victoria, who saw her as a cash cow, someone who might not appreciate her for who he felt she was. Once those worries were kind of allayed, he and Albert got on very, very well. And I didn't get the opportunities to show that because we were set up. I mean, much the way that it was in real life, that often you don't get the opportunities to express, you know, because the dramatics of your situation have placed you in a particular, you know, position. So I missed the opportunity to have a scene with me and Albert where I could just kind of be really nice to him and we could just get on. And I get that opportunity in season two. So it was very nice. We unencumbered by all these complications and, you know, imagined rivalries that kind of affect relationships. It was very nice to be able to be openly supportive to Victoria when she comes to me in need of advice, and to be able to just give it to her in an uncomplicated way rather than having to kind of veil it. Because I think Melbourne's attitude didn't change that much. He was just able to express it more freely. I mean, I think in his own way, he was trying to make it easier for them to get together in season one. It was just a little bit more complicated. This time, she's able, as a happily married woman, to come to him and say, I'm having awful trouble with the husband. Can you give me any advice? And he can say, yes, love. Why don't you try this? He's not all that bad, you know. And it was really nice to be able to do that, you know.
The other evening, when Albert was talking to Lady Lovelace about decimal places, he looked so happy.
Oh, come now. Such suspicion is beneath you. Besides, the man is intent on flirtation. In my experience, he does not tend to resort to mathematics.
I've missed you, Lord M. You always know how to make me feel better.
Lord M is undergoing a treatment of regular bloodletting and a diet of beef tea and Brussels biscuits. So I have to ask, were those actual leeches used in that scene?
No, they were bionic leeches. It was amazing, actually. I think a couple of them might have been CGI. I think there was one particularly rambunctious one that it might have been a digital creation. But there was one, there were these little things that there was a man had this little metal pipe and he was hiding. He was crouching on the, sorry to dash the illusion, crouching on the other side of my arm, pumping these little kind of weird sluglets that would inflate, deflate. And they'd moisten them, they put droplets on them, these little critters. And it was quite a fun day for them. Anyway, I didn't enjoy it.
Not so much for you. No. Why doesn't Lord M want Victoria specifically to know about his condition?
I think he doesn't want the fuss. I think that's why. And he cares for her, doesn't want to distract her. And in the end, he kind of also does want her to know. You know, these things are complicated. You do and you don't. So I think when Albert ignores his entreaties, he's kind of slightly embarrassed and feels unmanned by her coming and seeing him, but at the same time is delighted to see her and very touched and very pleased, you know, because you can two conflicting feelings at the same time. And I think, you know, he was very secretly very pleased.
Victoria says, "We cannot be as we were," to which Lord M replies, "No, indeed." But they do end up waltzing together to seize the moment, as it were. And it's here that Lord M seems to suffer a stroke before our eyes. What was it like filming this scene?
Well, it's really difficult to pull off a waltz and a stroke at the same time, as you could guess. But it was, you know, one of the concerns and one of the tricks of doing it is, for me, was not to be too melodramatic. I mean, you didn't want something to be so big that it would cause an enormous commotion, because also, in terms of the scene, she's apparently not supposed to notice. So, you know, one had to measure it out in such a way as to fit the scene. But, I mean, I'm speaking technically there, but it was a very, very difficult to strike the right balance with that, because also, just up until that moment, he's really trying to say how he's proud of the fact that she's managed to make a success of her relationship, and he's very happy for her. And he's in the midst of that when whatever it is that happens, happens. And that was the thing that I was concentrating more on, you know. And then he's just kind of, he's cut off.
We get a taste in this episode of the close friendship between Lord M and Anna Wilson-Jones's Lady Emma Portman, who says, "Mm-hmm. I've spent my life watching you, William." What do you make of the rapport between these two?
Well, I mean, I certainly hadn't been playing it like I was aware that she had feelings for me. So that came as kind of as much of a surprise for me as it did for Lord M, I think. But it's always, I mean, and Anna was so lovely to work with. I've really enjoyed, I mean, I've relished scenes with someone who was a mate, you know, someone who was, it was a chance to just give a glimmer of the fact. Something, the most interesting thing about Melbourne is that he just had great friendships with women. I mean, all of the scandals and troubles in his life were to do with being really attracted, not just sexually, but personally attracted to incredibly bright, independent, vivacious, intelligent, charismatic women. Because of his mother, I think, who had been this amazing, she was the centre of this kind of artistic, social. His father was a bit of what they'd have called a booby at the time. And the centre of the household was this brilliant, outrageous mother who took lovers and filled her house. It was kind of like a salon where all the great politicians and royals and artists and poets and debauchers of the day would circle. And that's what he grew up in. And it was very much, it's not the way you think of the Victorian era at all. This is the era that the Victorians reacted against. And he grew up with a great love of brilliant women. And so it was nice to have to show, I was only disappointed I didn't get to have more of that to show his female friends, which Lady Portman kind of represents. So it was just nice, the fact that he had as a confidant a woman. And I think that was very telling. And I always really love my scenes with Anna.
Now, you touched on this earlier. I love the scene between Lord M and Albert at Westminster Hall.
Yes.
I wish I had built something now. I have some sort of impression on this country.
You're the Prime Minister.
Oh, any damn fool can be Prime Minister, but to leave behind a thing of beauty, something like this, something that people will marvel over centuries from now. That's worth living for.
It's such a sad moment, this great man wishing that he had somehow been greater.
Yeah.
Is that ultimately the tragedy of Lord M?
No, I don't think so. I think that's just him. I mean, I don't think he was a personally, as I've said, he wasn't a personally ambitious man. It's just a man at a certain stage looking back over his life. And I don't think he saw himself in terms of being a great achiever. He'd have probably said, oh, I muddled through here and there. I mean, he was a very successful prime minister in that he stayed in power for a very, very long time. But he didn't have an aura of success about him because of the way he managed is, they say this, it's the same thing they say with successful mediation. No one's too happy. His own side felt he was giving away too much ground, and the opposite side felt that he wasn't giving away enough. So everyone was equally unhappy, which meant he managed to strike this great balance. No one thought of him as a great prime minister because he didn't seem to be particularly victorious or, you know, but his example was one that, if you look at it, you know, from a distance, was enormously successful. He's very, very good at what he did. He was just incredibly naturally gifted with intellect and with his personality, that he was able to appear to give ground and concede and not strike dogmatic positions in a way that made deals possible in a real way. And that, I believe, is why his biography by Lord David Cecil was Jack Kennedy's favourite book. And he always carried it with him, which was fascinating to discover. Because if you think of that way of dealing, it's very similar to what Kennedy did with the Cuban Missile Crisis, when it became necessary to give an out to the Russians so that they could walk away with what looked like a success. And that was a very Melbournean way of dealing with the situation. I mean, it's a wonderful book, and it was the thing that really influenced me. But it was very interesting that Kennedy loved it so much.
The Oxford Companion for British History describes him as kind, honest, and not self-seeking.
Yes.
Which perhaps is the highest acclaim you can give to a politician.
Yes, and you might say that that is why he would never have been described in his time as a gifted politician by other politicians. You know, because I think his own side would have been frustrated by those qualities, you know.
Before this next question, a brief word from our sponsors.
Ocean voyages, expeditions, river journeys. Viking is dedicated to bringing travelers closer to the destination, offering a small ship experience and a shore excursion in every port. Learn more at viking.com.
Looking to relive the first two seasons of Masterpieces Victoria? Get caught up with PBS Passport, member benefit from your local PBS station. To learn more, visit pbs.org/getpassport. Now, my favorite scene on par with the Rook scene in season one is the final scene between Victoria and Lord M, where she gives him the mechanical songbird. Given that neither is able to express how they're feeling within the rigidity of this moment, how difficult was this a scene to shoot?
Well, I can answer that two ways. In like any other of the scenes with Jenna, in one way it was easy, because I think, firstly, our response to the material was the same one. Basically, if we meet and we read through the scene, we hit it at the same point, and we don't need a lot of discussion about it. It's just naturally why it was so much fun working with Jenna, and why often we just wanted to kind of film it as quickly as we could to kind of catch the truth of it. So the difficulty with a scene like that was how many times we had to do it, because we had to film the scene from one angle so many times that by the time we came in to do the close-ups, you know, but there's a thing with a scene like that. You want to keep it as delicate as possible, as natural, and you don't want to be acting the moments. And one of the problems is when you do a scene for a very long time, you can do it very naturally and it can just happen. And if you're not careful, or even if you are careful, what can start to happen is you can start to impersonate the last good take you did rather than just inhabit it. And that's something that you just learn not to panic about and just let it come back in its own time. And luckily it did. But we did it so many times. But every time it had something different and new, and, you know, you don't try to repeat, you just try to kind of look at each other and mean it. But yeah, it was a nice day, but the challenge was just keeping it simple.
What do you think Lord M learned from Victoria herself?
I don't know. I mean, it's difficult to kind of to put it in words like that. I think he got so much from Victoria. I think, you know, he was very jaded. I don't mean jaded in a cynical way. If he had a cynicism, it was kind of a light-hearted one that wasn't, he wasn't jaded about humanity. He was aware of humanity's foibles, but he kind of made him smile, especially his own. But I think he was just kind of over it by the time he met Victoria. He was on the way out. He was fed up with politics. He just wanted to go home and tootle about, you know. His crowning achievement really was that relationship, I think, because he'd lost a child. He'd been in and out of all these incredibly torrid relationships. And there's something about the simplicity and the purity of her and the relationship that kind of encapsulated so many things that he needed. He might not have realised that he needed, but, you know, the desire to be a kind of father, of a great female friend, to be able to impart some kind of wisdom and give good advice and not so much of the nonsense advice that people were full of. It just gave him this tremendous purpose late in life that was just, I think, that became his crowning achievement, really. And I think it was very, very sad for him when that ended, but I don't think he would... That doesn't mean he would have wanted to extend it. I think that would have been even sadder for him. I mean, the same way I feel about the job, actually. I would not like to hang around too long in this part because I like the part too much, you know?
Now, their relationship comes to an end, not with a loving embrace, but with a simple touch of the hand. Why was it important that their final encounter play out this way, with that level of physical distance?
Well, because I think a simple touch of the hand is no small thing. I mean, it's not necessarily true that a hug has more warmth and feeling and contact than a touch of a hand. You can, you know, there can be hugs that are entirely empty and devoid of feeling. It's all about the context. And I just think for them to have hugged would just actually create more discomfort and embarrassment. It would actually have taken them out of that moment. The simplicity of it was far more in keeping with it and far more, I think, very, very moving, I think.
The final shot of the episode features Lord M staring at the Mozart whistling mechanical songbird as it stops singing, which broke my heart.
Yeah.
The script is very sparse on detail for that moment. It just says, the bird stops its song and we see Melbourne's face. What
yes.
did you want to convey in that moment with that expression?
That I'd died. As far as I'm concerned, I went back to die. If they're not telling people that, then that's fine. But, you know... What did I want to convey? I wanted to convey that I was dying, but it doesn't seem very clear. I was very surprised that people didn't realize that I was dead.
I mean, even Daisy in interviews, she wrote something recently. She says, every time I imagine writing more Victoria, I can feel him, as in Lord M, creeping into the edge of my consciousness. He is the old flame that you never quite get over, the one that got away.
I mean, so yes, she said that since, but which is very nice. But at the time, I was under the impression that I was sitting there having a final stroke rather than just staring at a bird, but, you know.
To each his own.
Well, not really. Death isn't quite like that. It seems to be pretty final. But yes, that's as far as I'm concerned. If you're asking me what I'm thinking, I wasn't thinking anything by the end of the scene.
The episode constructs a parallel between the death of Lord M and that of Victoria's dog, Dash. Even if the affection the Queen felt was perhaps equal, how do you feel about your character being compared to a spaniel?
It's just not the kind of dog that I'd expect to be compared to. I think something slightly more bigger and googly-eyed, but, you know, you pick your dogs.
A Labrador?
Well, possibly. I don't think we can pick the dogs that we are. Maybe the spaniel is the right dog for me. Who knows?
Is it true that your final performance as Lord M reduced Daisy Goodwin to tears on the set this season?
My first one. It's the first rehearsal.
Oh, what was that?
Well, that was it. The first rehearsal of that scene. And as I said, it was a really, really long day. So, I mean, we read through it the first time. Just, you know, it's like, okay, let's just read through the scene and decide what we're going to do. Halfway through that, I was aware of sobbing in the corner. I mean, which was nice. It was a tad distracting, but it was, you know, encouragement, I suppose you could call it. Kind of sobbing cheerleader in the corner.
Sobbing cheerleader, I think, is what we all need if we're preparing for a death scene. Now, some fans of the show were quite upset that Lord M would return just to die, with one viewer writing on Twitter, in all caps, mind you, "I can't believe they brought back Lord Melbourne just to kill him off. What the actual expletive."
Yes.
What do you make of that reaction?
Well, it's the opposite of mine. I mean, this is the reason I answer kind of vehemently, because no one else seems to be doing it, so I'll do it. I wouldn't have come back if I hadn't been dying. For me, because I don't like, it feels a little undignified to be just hanging around on the off chance of being brought back to dispense advice. I'd rather snuff it. You know, there's more of a dignity in just kind of, all right, now on with the story, you know, because I think there's a limit to the shelf life of that character, as there was in real life. And once his actual purpose and the natural dynamic of that relationship is over, I'd rather just leave it at what was its best, rather than just kind of bring it back in some kind of ever diminishing version, you know. So for me, the fact that, as far as I was concerned, he comes back, he's ill, and then he dies, and then she moves on, was very important to kind of close that door. So I'm very flattered that people don't like that, but my perspective was slightly different. Even though I will really, I mean, as I keep on telling Daisy, I'll do a prequel because I'm still younger than Melbourne was, luckily. But you know, I wouldn't really. It was quite an important part of it was to kind of close the door, even though it's a very sad thing to do, you know?
Well, I would love for you to star in a show called M that basically is
yes, exactly.
All about Lord Melbourne before this.
Yeah.
Looking back at your time as Lord M over these past two seasons of Victoria, is there a scene that sticks out at you, a personal favorite?
Not really. I mean, there's the scenes, there's the big scenes, you know, I had a good time just doing the little silly scenes, some of which got cut. We had a kind of loads of early little scenes with me tutoring a young, errant, cheeky Victoria and trying to, you know, school her on the ways of the court, etc., etc., and her being just a kind of naughty young thing trying to distract me. And, you know, I mean, the wonderful truth about the two of them is they were kind of incorrigible together. They used to get drunk. I mean, we never had one of those scenes, that was to my great disappointment. But, actually, it's just the scenes of us just hanging about. I mean, obviously, I'm very proud of and love the dramatic scenes, but the ones that I look back on fondly are the ones that where we were just kind of larking around together.
And what's next for you now?
At the moment, I say with great pleasure, nothing. And I'm sure that pleasure will curdle, you know, by the time I'm back home. But I finished doing the third season of Man in the High Castle on a night shoot this Saturday. So I've been pretty busy with that. And season three is, you know, quite intense and bigger still than the last one and quite exciting. And nothing has really come my way that seemed more appealing than not doing anything for a little while. But, you know, as my old agent Julian Belford used to say, my greatest asset is my availability.
Well, enjoy some much-deserved respite in the meantime.
Thank you.
Rufus Sewell, thank you so much for joining us again.
All right, thanks a lot.
Prince Albert takes control in this second season of Victoria. His wife has noticed, and she's not exactly pleased. Actor Tom Hughes discusses how Albert and Victoria's relationship both deepens and fractures this season.
He's recognized that the world is changing, and in a way that it's irrevocable. It will never be the same. And perhaps this is the avenue he can travel down, where he can have the greatest of impact, if you like. And also can get that expression that he so dearly craves.
Watch for our interview with Hughes, appearing next week in your podcast feeds. The Victoria Sweepstakes is happening now through March 15th, 2018. Enter daily at pbs.org/sweepstakes for a chance to win the grand prize, a Viking ocean cruise for two adults in the British Isles. You may also win monthly prizes of Victoria merchandise. for official rules, including eligibility restrictions and prize limitations, visit pbs.org/sweepstakes. Void where prohibited. Masterpiece Studio is hosted by me, Jace Lacob, and produced by Nick Anderson. Alicia Baitoop is our editor. Suzanne Simpson is our executive producer. The executive producer of Masterpiece is Rebecca Eaton. Sponsors for Masterpiece on PBS are Viking Cruises and the Masterpiece Trust.